We'll hear you now in State of Missouri versus Johnny A. Johnson, felon.
Excuse me. May it please the court, good afternoon. I'd like to just take a moment and give you some handouts that...
You give them to the marshal.
Okay, thank you very much.
Counsel, before you get started, I'd like to know whether your client has authorized this.
I believe he and I have been talking about the appeal the whole time. I'm not aware there's any question about whether he had it.
Well, the reason is there were a number of references in the briefs to the fact that he wanted to die because of what he did to this little girl. And that he deserved the death penalty.
I think he felt terrible. I think he does want the appeal what the defense was at trial and what I think he still seeks on appeal. In fact, it's interesting you bring that up because one of the last things I was going to suggest to the court is a sort of revolutionary notion that doesn't usually happen in criminal cases, but I was going to suggest perhaps the court might consider some kind of settlement conference for the parties. I know other appellate courts, the lower courts, do that in civil cases. And when a case goes up on appeal, they set a time for the parties to talk about it. Johnny's claim is that he did not deliberate. He admits to killing the little girl. And, you know, for what it's worth, we are willing to talk about that. But that's, you know, to answer your question, he does want this appeal to go forward. Thank you. Today, I'd like us to talk about jury selection. And to open this discussion, I offer you two propositions. The first comes from this court, and it's a paraphrase of a quote from State v. Leisure. In State v. Leisure, this court said, and this is the proposition, voir dire is both an educational and a discovery process. The existence and depths of prejudice in prospective jurors can only be accurately determined if a juror understands the legal requirements of her responsibility as a juror. And this is a critical part, we do not expect the veneer to come to court with a legally sufficient or correct understanding of the requirements the law imposes on jurors. Now, with that in mind, let me offer you the second proposition. And the second proposition is that jury selection is a lot like an employment interview. In both instances, the goal is to find a qualified person. An employer wants someone who has the abilities, the skills for the job. Attorneys and the judge are looking for jurors with the ability to be fair and impartial and apply the law to the facts. Now, in both situations, an exchange of information is important. There's got to be...
That system works on the basis of disqualifying jurors. To find a jury panel or group to be the jury, dismiss jurors for cause or we dismiss jurors peremptorily. But it's not like we sort of look for jurors, panels there, and we disqualify jurors, not add jurors.
Exactly. And in that sense, it's also like an employment interview. You know, jurors come in. Now, they are not applying to be jurors. That's certainly true. They are summoned. They have to come in. But once they get there, you know, it's up to the attorneys in the court to determine, are these people qualified? Who's qualified? Who's not? If they're not qualified, then it's like the employment situation where you shake hands, say goodbye, thank you very much, and you don't, you know, call them back for the second interview. And that's what happens in jury selection. Okay. Picking a jury is a little bit different, though. If we hire an employee who doesn't have the right qualifications, turns out not to be the right person, the employer will find out, and there's an opportunity to make a correction. The employer can provide additional training, perhaps shift the person to a different job, and if necessary, terminate the employment. But in picking a jury, we don't get to go into the jury room. We don't get to make corrections. If the jurors are not qualified, we may never know. For that reason, I think it's really important that getting the necessary information be a first priority. In Morgan v. Illinois, the Supreme Court said part of the guarantee of the defendant's right to trial is an adequate voir dire to identify unqualified jurors. Morgan also said, and this court said in Clark, that follow the law questions and are not enough, that there has to be some disclosure of critical facts. In the context of a first-degree murder case, among those critical facts are what the jury is going to be asked to decide. It's not enough to say to the jurors, the defendant is charged with first-degree murder, and the range of punishment for first-degree murder is a sentence of life imprisonment without probation or parole or death. And then to say, could you consider both sentences? Well, what's missing from this equation is the juror's understanding, an accurate understanding of what we're talking about when we say first-degree murder. Jurors may come into court with an idea of what first-degree murder is. It could be completely wrong. When the trial attorneys were doing jury selection in this case, and they were at the bench, they spoke to the judge about the questions they wanted to ask, and they pretty much made an offer of proof. There were some panels where they were allowed to ask the question, but eventually they were shut down, and they didn't get to it. And I think maybe there were two panels at most where they were able to ask that question about fully reflective, deliberate murder. That's what they wanted to get out. They explained that sometimes when they, and these are experienced attorneys, when they've done jury selection, they've gone into court and they've asked that question, and jurors have responded with things like, well, if it's an accident, sure. Or if it's self-defense, no problem. But that's not, you know, that's not first-degree murder. That's something very different. So we have to make sure that jurors know this. One of the questions I had about this issue as I read through the cases and I read the state's brief is it's not clear to me at all why we don't allow this question. I cannot think of a good reason why trial attorneys, defense attorneys, trying to pick a jury that is life qualified, meaning like a death qualified jury is a jury that can consider a sentence of death. A life qualified jury is a jury that can consider a sentence of life. The jurors have to be able to do both. I cannot think of a reason why it would be inappropriate to say to the jury, to ask this question on voir dire, to say, you will be asked, if the case goes to penalty phase, because they, you know, they have to do the death qualification ahead of time, if the case goes to penalty phase, you will be asked to consider, to decide whether life imprisonment without probation or parole or death is the appropriate punishment. And then they say to the jurors, could you consider both those punishments? Now, what would be wrong with saying you need to know first-degree murder is a coolly reflective, deliberate murder? I cannot think of a problem with doing that. I don't know why we don't do that.
You're not talking about, because of course you don't want them to have to commit on the particular fact. They could go so far into details, but you're talking about
universal facts. Basically, they're universal facts. If a first-degree murder is charged, the fact that it's coolly reflective is going to be the same in every case, right? You know, on other occasions, I've stood before the court and I've talked about instructions. You know, we have to alter instructions that we don't always get them right. It occurs to me that if there's any problem at all with this, it could be the problem that there's a risk that maybe too much will come out, that maybe...
Was this a principal defense at trial? That he didn't deliberate?
Yes. Yes, that he did not deliberate, which is, again, why this is really prejudicial.
It's a tough sell, given the facts of the case. I don't understand how that could be a viable defense, actually. Maybe that was all there was to say.
Well, the facts are that Johnny Johnson had a long, long history of mental illness. And because of that mental...
He didn't plead not guilty by mental disease or defect.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But, you know, there are cases that say, in fact, there's a case that just came down, or else maybe the court just took cert on it, the U.S. Supreme Court, that it's a recent case that talks about even if... It was a Western District case. It was a Western District case. It just came down this past week. And it said even if the defense isn't, you know, you're not using a 552 defense, you're allowed to put on evidence to challenge the element of deliberation. And that's what Johnny's mental disease, his mental health issues, which go as far back as kindergarten.
It just seems that the evidence of deliberation was overwhelming in this case, so I guess I'm getting at how were you prejudiced?
Let me go into that there, because in terms of jury selection, it's structural error. I mean, everyone, even the most guilty of guilty people, is entitled to a fair and impartial jury. We don't get into prejudice. You know, you and I have been talking about it, but the fact is, this is not an issue that this court or any court reviews for prejudice. It's error in jury selection is structural error.
Yeah, but if the error pertains to something that is not an issue in the case, hardly, I guess you say it. I just don't understand how deliberation. I don't understand the defense.
Well, we may get into that a little bit later, but the defense was that he was so mentally distraught at the time that
there was no insanity defense.
It was not an NGRI defense. It was not guilty by reason of insanity. One of the things that happened in this case is the trial attorneys kind of bent over backwards to put out all the evidence, good and bad, about Johnny. Some of it was not favorable to him. But one of the salient facts is that Johnny has a long history of mental illness. As I said before, he doesn't deny killing the little girl. He denies that it was a deliberate homicide, an intentional homicide, but not a coolly reflected homicide.
Well,
and there is a difference.
I don't understand that from the facts. Let me just read some of this. Kidnapped the little six-year-old girl, took her to a remote place down in a silo-like pit, took her down into this pit so that she couldn't extricate herself. Appellant then asked the victim to pull down her panties so he could see her vagina. When she said no, appellant grabbed the victim's underwear, tearing it off her, forcing her to the ground. He then got on top of her, pinning her to the ground with his chest, started rubbing his penis on her leg to try to get an erection. The victim started screaming, kicking, and pushing at appellant, scratching his chest. Appellant got up and, even though he had not yet raped the victim, decided to go ahead and kill her. He grabbed a brick and hit her in the head with at least six times, causing bleeding and bruising but not killing her or rendering her unconscious. After the victim was struck the first time, she started to run around the pit, leaving blood in various places around the pit. When appellant hit her with it again, the victim fell to her knees, sagging to the ground, but she continued to try to crawl away from the appellant. Appellant struck the victim with the brick again, eventually knocking her to the ground, and at some point fracturing the right side of her skull with the brick. At that point, because the victim was still moving around, appellant lifted a rather large boulder about the size of a basketball over his head and brought it down on the back left side of the victim's head and neck, causing multiple fractures of her skull. The victim inhaled and exhaled really fast and then stopped breathing. How can you say there's no deliberation?
Your Honor, the question is, Do we give a fair and impartial jury to everyone the state chooses to take to trial, or only to those people who we think there's a reasonable question about whether they committed the act or not? This country, everyone under the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment gets a fair and impartial jury.
How's deliberation an issue, though? I don't understand.
Well, we're talking about jury selection. And, you know, the defense at trial was no deliberation. What I'm saying now, Johnny Johnson was entitled, if you were on that jury, you may have found deliberation. But Johnny's entitled to a fair jury that can consider both sides. If you're saying that maybe the jury in jury selection needs to hear all those facts, you know, if that's the point, that to pick a fair and impartial jury, we need far more than just, you know, the question of fully reflective, deliberate killing. If we need to go into, if all of these are such critical facts that to select a jury, we have to bring them all out in, you know, in during voir dire, maybe we do. That's not what we're saying, but if that's what you're suggesting, you know, that's a fair suggestion. It could be. I think it will depend on the facts of the case. There may be some cases. Clark was one. You know, this case was another where there's a child.
Do you have any cases that say you have to ask that it's a structural error to deny the defense the right to ask this question about state of mind and whether you're fully deliberative or not? Is there any case that's done what you're asking?
There are cases, Morgan v. Illinois, the line of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court talks about in terms of the Eighth Amendment and in terms of the Sixth Amendment, that in selecting the jury that you have to have an adequate voir dire. A voir dire that's adequate, but not saying, about this specific
question. You're
saying
it's structural error, so you're saying basically every death penalty case that hasn't had that asked has structural error in it.
Well, I'm saying from here on out we should be doing this. I'm saying when you look at the cases that have been decided that have said, you know, that's a separate question, does this become retroactive? Do we go back? And frankly, I don't think so. You know, I don't think the court would open it up that way. That's, you know, you control that.
But trying to define deliberation during voir dire, isn't that the job of the trial court to instruct the jury on the law?
It is. Absolutely it is. And one of the things that I'm suggesting to the court is if it's inappropriate for the trial attorneys to bring out these elements, when the trial court reads 300.03AA, that's the instruction that is read before death qualification, that instruction talks about the fact that the defendant's charged with first-degree murder. It would be a very simple thing to add a sentence or two saying, first-degree murder is, and that would go right in the definition. It would be read to the jury. They would have that information. Boom, boom. I think that would
take... But there's sort of two different issues. One is, would that be a good thing to add? Is that something that would be okay to add that wouldn't be inappropriate to add? But you're asking us to say it's structural error not to have it in, where you don't have any case which has held that or said it's required to do it here or elsewhere, it sounds like. You have to adequately instruct question them, certainly.
I guess I'm generalizing. I'm saying if the jury selection is not fair, if the jury selection is not adequate to weed out jurors who cannot be fair and impartial, who are not qualified, who could not consider a sentence of life in this case, then it is an inadequate jury selection and it is structural error. That's what I'm saying.
But in this case, weren't the veneer members asked if they could consider a life sentence?
One of the veneer...
Wasn't the veneer panel members asked if they could consider a life sentence?
There were several small panels. This occurred during death qualification, which the trial court did first. And during death qualification, they were in panels of 10. The first panel, defense counsel attempted to ask the question and was not allowed to do so. Second panel, defense counsel was allowed to ask. None of those jurors ended up on the jury. For various reasons, they were eliminated. Some for cause, some peremptory strikes. The third panel, again, the defense attorney tried to ask the question and was stopped. There was an objection, was stopped. Fourth panel, That time, defense attorney, they were taking turns. The defense attorney was stopped. So there was really only one panel where the defense was allowed to go into that. And at that point, they made a very large record setting out exactly the question they wanted to ask, why they wanted to ask it. So there, you know, this occurred a number of times where they tried to ask it and were denied. There was one time they were allowed to ask the question in the small panel, but none of those jurors served. So that didn't help. I do want to point to cases where we're talking about cases where this has been allowed and not allowed. In the brief, I talked about similar cases where the attorneys have been allowed to ask about things like accessory liability, reasonable doubt, felony murder, plea bargaining, circumstantial evidence. Felony murder, acting with another, those are legal principles. The juries get instructions on those also. I don't see the difference. If anything, I would think there is a greater need in a death penalty case to make sure that the jurors have sufficient information to give accurate answers on voir dire. We don't want to select a jury to whom we've said, could you consider a sentence of life? Oh, yes. Could you consider a sentence of death? Oh, yes. But they really don't know the crime for which they're being asked to consider those punishments. And that's the dilemma.
They knew it involved the bludgeoning death of a 6-year-old girl, and they all said that they could consider life.
And that's a fact. But, you know, it's also, remember, you're taking your facts from the state's brief. And the way the facts come in at trial is not in a narrative form like that.
Well, I was taking the confession of your client.
Well, I still think, Your Honor, that it's up to the jury to decide if that confession is credible, if, you know, and if even if it is.
I didn't think that part of the trial was in dispute.
And even if it is, if it's not in dispute, it's still up to the jury to decide, is that a planned, coolly reflected act? Is that person acting with cool reflection? Even if they know what they're doing, that's second-degree murder. Somebody could bludgeon, you know, I could use my glasses, I could use this pitcher and bludgeon something and know what I'm doing and have never coolly reflected on it. There is a difference. First-degree murder and second-degree murder are very close. It's the cool reflection.
He decided he wanted to kill her.
I beg your pardon?
He told in his confession that he decided that he wanted to kill her.
Well, that's a confession he made to Detective Newsham, who, and that's another point in the brief, and that has to do with whether perhaps Detective Newsham was making things up.
Wasn't that videotaped?
No, it wasn't videotaped. It wasn't. Mm-mm. But Detective Newsham's facts did not correspond at all to the nurse's notes at the jail. Detective Newsham, according to Detective Newsham, he is having a conversation with Johnny, and Johnny's saying, oh, yeah, I want to get everything straight. At the time, according to the nurse's notes, Johnny is being admitted, booked. He's Detective Newsham has said goodbye. It's there are problems with the statement he made to Detective Newsham. I do want to talk briefly about Batson. I've just got a little bit of time left, and I gave you some handouts on that as well. If you look at them, one of the things those handouts will show you pretty clearly is that to strike, especially Ms. Gilbert, the state had to jump over any number of jurors who did not have minor children. I call them minorless jurors. And you have to ask why. If you look at the handout that's there's a handout in color and there's one that's just a chart, you can pretty clearly see that there were favorable jurors to the defense who the state would want to strike. And yet, even though there's nothing that the state really knows about Ms. Gilbert, he strikes her. So you have to ask why. Why does he strike this woman, this Asian woman, instead of Juror Travers, a male, a Caucasian male? And that's the question. Thank you very much. If there are no further questions, save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. To start with the second point, as appellant did, and to try to actually bring it back to what's truly the relevant question before this court, is did the trial court abuse its discretion by not allowing the questions that appellant wanted to ask during voir dire? And respondent finds it nearly impossible to call the trial court's ruling here an abuse of discretion when this court has repeatedly stated that it is not proper to define the elements of the offenses during voir dire. And that is precisely what the trial court said. The trial court said there are numerous cases that say that's improper. To find an abuse of discretion for a trial court following the binding precedent that controls it would be an absurdity, and obviously not compelled by this case. And I think that comes across from appellant's presentation. Appellant's presentation here is, well, should this be? Is this a good way to do it? Would it be better to do it some other way? That's not the question when it comes to determining abuse of discretion. Abuse of discretion is whether the court, in its broad discretion, made such an error that reasonable people couldn't agree that the trial court's action was correct. Here, the cases that appellant cites are irrelevant. Most, if not all, of those cases, the issue was a trial court allowed some questioning into different legal principles. Had the trial court done that here, yes, it would have still been technically error because this court has said that's not proper. Would it have satisfied the concept of an abuse of discretion? Well, we don't know that. Maybe it would have been an abuse of discretion. Maybe it wouldn't have to allow the court to question on that. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about what a court should allow, which is all of her cases talk about. Should the court, you know, why did the court allow this and should they have? The question is, was the court abusing discretion and not allowing questions that this court has repeatedly said should not be asked? We think the answer to that question is no. This court's opinions state repeatedly that the answer to that question is no, it's not an abuse of discretion. And therefore, we believe that in and of itself disposes of appellant's claim. However, to go on to the prejudice issue, this idea of structural error, we would agree that there is structural error when biased and unfair jurors are permitted to sit on a panel. I think this court has stated that before in various cases, Nice versus State, for example. However, there's no showing here that any juror was biased or unqualified.
Do you have to show that they're biased, or do you have to? I think she's saying if she shows she wasn't allowed to ask the question she needed to ask to determine whether they were biased. That's structural error, too.
And I'm not familiar with that being declared structural error. The only structural error I'm aware of in the realm of jury selection is when it actually results in biased or unfair jurors, at which point I think you could make a claim for structural error. Even here, though, the voir dire, as permitted by the court, was more than adequate to ensure that the jury could render in this case, based on the facts that the court has already indicated today, as horrific as they are. We see that not only could this jury have considered it appellant's life or death choice, but that, in fact, they actually did. First of all, the jury, simply put, the jury was aware that this is the most severe degree of murder that we have. It's murder in the first degree. And I think that in today's culture, we have a jury audience that's a little more aware of legal principles based on what's available in popular culture today. So just by saying murder in the first degree, that alerts the jury, yeah, this is really serious. Can I consider it when it's really serious? More importantly, the jury was aware of numerous facts in this case which would suggest that we're talking about a very serious offense. First of all, they were aware that the victim was a 6-year-old girl. They were aware that appellant was also charged with kidnapping, attempting to rape, and using a weapon against her. And most importantly for the defense point of view, they were asked if they could consider what was the real true defense here, was that could they consider appellant's mental illness as a reason to consider life instead of death? All of the jurors who sat on the jury indicated that they could consider all of these facts and still consider life. Based upon that much commitment to the facts of the case and the presentations of the defense, And we are talking here about a diminished capacity defense. He was unable to deliberate, that he was acting under command hallucinations. And that was what they really presented as their idea of why he didn't deliberate.
Now, your opposing counsel said that not all veneer panels were asked the question on whether or not they could consider a life sentence. Can you respond to that?
I believe that they were, and I think I cite to the brief, at least all of the panels that from which jurors were drawn. One thing I had taken heard that there was one panel that was actually allowed these questions without objection, and none of those veneer members actually sat on the jury. And so any panel that actually sat was not asked this question about, well, we're not talking about accident, which there's nothing in this case that suggests this was an accident. We're not talking about self-defense, obviously not a case of self-defense. And it's not an idea of a jealous spouse shooting their husband or wife because they've caught him with a lover. Those are the scenarios that they wanted to present. The jury was well aware from just the statement of the facts that were presented for them that we weren't talking about these situations where death might have been understandable or might have even been justified, but that this was a horrific, serious murder case. The jury knew that. And once we take that, and it's interesting, appellant in several other places in his brief states that this was a close case on the issue of whether there was deliberation. The jury deliberated 4 hours on the issue, and this was the only issue before it. On death, they deliberated even longer over whether to give life or death. Obviously, this jury took its obligation to consider both life and death very, very seriously, and that they did consider, and they did work over whether or not there was deliberation, and they decided, and we believe rightfully so, based on what you have heard today about this case, that there was, in fact, deliberation in this case. The appellant suffered absolutely zero prejudice from not being allowed to ask questions. The jury committed to being able to follow the law. This court has repeatedly said that the jury instructions defining first and second degree murder clearly delineate between the two. The jury had all of that before it, and it was able to use those instructions and able to reach a well-reasoned and correct decision in this case. As to point one, I see these charts, and we see this suggestion that the state had to leap over other jurors, which not only are the same, but in fact would probably be better state's jurors than the jurors who actually sat. Once again, with that missing the real question of what we're talking about here. The real question of talking about it is, did the state provide sufficiently race-neutral reasons to explain its strikes of one African-American male juror and one Asian female juror, when, in fact, the state left other minority panelists on the jury? And the answer to that question is yes. I think appellant's claim is trying to take Batson from a command for race neutrality into a place of racial preference, where if you've got a jury panel, you have to strike the Caucasians and you have to strike the men first. That you're not allowed to consider factors and apply them, even if you're applying them race neutrally, you're not allowed to apply them to either minorities or to women. And that's not what Batson says, and it's almost insulting to suggest that's what Batson means, because Batson does strive for race neutrality, and in fact Batson has actually been applied and was in this case against strikes by people against based on sex when you're talking about men and based on race when you're talking about Caucasians. The question is, we look at the prosecutor's reasons given, and we look at and see if they're applied race neutrally. And here, there are two huge reasons that show why they're applied race neutrally. One, the reasons were applied equally to Caucasian veneer members that were applied to the minority veneer members. We're pointing out that, yeah, there are a lot of jurors here who didn't have minor children. And it so happens that the state used all of its strikes to strike veneer members who had no children. As Judge Stith said in Ashley, once you've exhausted your strikes, you have no more strikes to get rid of other people who might be similarly situated. That in and of itself doesn't show that it was pretextual, because you tried to strike as many as you could. And here, yeah, it would have been impossible for the state to strike them all. But to consider the fact, or to say that having no minor children was not a race-neutral or even a relevant thing to this case, it was obviously a relevant thing in this case with such a young victim, and for the state to believe. And once again, when we're talking about that's it. And we're talking about peremptory challenges. We're not talking about whether the jurors were qualified. Every veneer member left on the panel was qualified at this point. The question is, who would you prefer to have on the jury? And if the state wants to say, I've got a child victim, and what I would like is I would like parents who are going to have children themselves closer in age to that child, I think that that's going to make my appeal for the ultimate punishment all the more convincing. That's obviously a relevant factor for the court to take for the prosecutor to take into determination when he's saying, do I want to strike people who have minor children or not minor children? As for the suggestion that, well, they didn't know a lot about their experiences, the prosecutor didn't really ask about the minor children, there are lots of times when voir dire isn't going to necessarily open itself up to asking about every possible reason that you can think of for why you might strike. And there's a lot of times that both prosecutors and defense attorneys and private civil attorneys are going to have to make strikes based on not having a tremendous amount of knowledge. Here, to think that you would have to ask who has minor children or not is somewhat irrelevant, since they'd already been asked that question through the questionnaire and was before all the jurors anyhow. And finally on that, to suggest that, well, here's somebody who had no minor children, here's somebody who had no minor children, why didn't you strike them instead? You're getting to a point where once again, appellant is seeking to say, well, if you've got white jurors who have no minor children, you have to strike them first instead of striking a minority. Once again, we're going into racial reasons to strike, which is prohibited, instead of a race-neutral reason applied both equally to Caucasians and to minorities. The second reason here, an appellant tries to make a lot of this saying that it was, quote, other reasons, this amorphous other reasons. The prosecutor's statement in context, though, made it clear that the other reasons referred back to the second reason for the two strikes, and that was the employment status of the two jurors. One, and really there isn't much of an argument, as the argument seems to be honed down to specifically Ms. Gilbert. But as for Mr. Murphy was a youth specialist with the Division of Youth Services, and appellant's defense was based largely on his bad childhood with a lot of learning disabilities leading to mental illness, which affected which not only affects his ability to deliberate and actually commit the crime, but also should be a reason to show mercy on him. For the state to believe that such a juror might somewhat be predisposed to where he works with troubled kids who have learning disabilities, some of which may eventually develop mental illness, to think that that person's exposure to such a background is not a race-neutral reason.
Is it much of an extension if you're saying that the prosecutor wanted to have a jury that were parents of children about the same age as the victim? Is it too far an extension to say that the prosecutor also wants a jury that's not like the defendant, meaning a white jury versus a black versus a black defendant?
And the answer to that under Batson is no, that's not relevant, and no, that's not what the prosecutor did here, because
it's relevant to say you want parents of children about the same
right.
age as the victim, but not that you don't want jurors that are different, that are like the defendant.
Right, and the reason why, I mean, Batson doesn't say you can't use generalizations about people to determine proper strikes. What it says is you can't use generalizations based on race. And JAB extends that to can't use generalizations based on sex. You can use generalizations based on a number of other things. And this court has at least on a couple of occasions now, expressed some reticence about employment-related reasons, but has said, but they're okay, where the prosecutor actually explains it and doesn't just say, oh, postal worker. Oh, okay, postal worker, we'll strike them. No. Here, the prosecutor made his explanations with the Division of Youth Services. Once he said, I fear that person might be sympathetic to such a defense, and which is something that courts have upheld before, and which is something that is clearly not only race-neutral but relevant to the case at hand.
Scott, but what was the racial composition of the jury as it ended up?
We do not know. Appellant did not make his record on that. All that we do know is that there were minorities left on the jury, because during the Batson challenges, the prosecutor said there are still, and I can't remember if he said minorities or African Americans or however. Once again, this is kind of an odd Batson challenge because we're dealing with mixed racial background. We're dealing with one African American, one Asian American, and
what do we know about the challenges that were made? The racial composition of
what we know is one Asian American, one African American, the remainder were Caucasian.
of the
by the prosecutor. So all the remaining prosecutor strikes, at least on the main veneer panel, were Caucasians, and all of them had no minor children. As I was explaining on employment status, once again, this is what the prosecutor said. So this is another reason. This isn't the state trying to make up new reasons. This is the reason given. When we start to look, and that wasn't challenged at trial by appellant. Appellant didn't go, well, I have some similarly situated worker-type people who would be in that same thing. And that's really because there wasn't. Of all the remaining jurors, the minimum any of them had been at their jobs was 5 years. So stable employment, life experience. That's the term the prosecutor used. I'm looking for certain life experiences, and I don't feel a student, which is what Ms. Gilbert indicated her job was, I don't feel students have that kind of life experience. And that bears out in the type of people the prosecutors say. I want people with stable work environments who've done a lot of life. And that's not, you know, while it may not be specifically case-specific, it's not irrational for a prosecutor to prefer certain types of jurors. I want people who've shown over time that they are, you know, they're committed to a society, maybe more partial to be law and order, maybe more partial to see things my way. And once again, we're talking about peremptory challenges. We're looking for jurors who we think are going to want to lean our way. So employment was obviously important. When you look at the jurors that the prosecutor did strike, one was unemployed. I think two had been employed for maybe a year at their jobs. And once again, you see this trend among the Caucasian strikes also being the same. And that idea of striking Caucasians instead of other minorities, that comes from Ashley again, from the Western District, and in that site, Schoen, where the prosecutor could have used more strikes against minorities, but did not. And that's not to say that that can't be a step one. You still can't show step one prima facie. But what it shows is that, hey, maybe we should believe the prosecutor when he says this wasn't racially motivated, but was racially neutral, when he uses it on Caucasians as well as on minority jurors. With those two facts, that he struck Caucasians for the same reasons and that he didn't strike minorities when he had the opportunity, then I think that that clearly shows that the prosecutor here was not engaging in discrimination in selecting his jurors, but was trying to find jurors based on his experience with certain employments, with certain child statuses that would be beneficial to his case. There's some talk in the brief mentioned about mannerisms. Prosecutor at one point talked about mannerisms. The prosecutor did not mention mannerisms when he was talking about the reasons for striking the two that he struck. He did mention mannerisms as did two of the similarly situated people mentioned. And appellants seem to say, well, that's not proper because you didn't mention it at the time. For the prosecutor to anticipate who was going to be called reasonably similarly situated and say, essentially you'd have a prosecutor having to interrupt every 3 minutes in the voir dire and say, oh, number 68's yawning. Oh, number 42 just shook his head. And have to start making this record. Oh, he's nodding. He likes what I had to say. I mean, we're getting to the point where we do have to still recognize there is deference available to the trial court to have observed this courtroom. And what he said is, oh, those two, even though, yes, they have no minor children, they appeared to be very strong towards the death penalty, which is what I'm seeking here in this case. Finally, there is some point raised in the brief about the fact that the court denied the Batson challenge early, that it denied the Batson challenge before giving the defense an opportunity to say, well, it's pretextual. And admittedly, the trial court did say denied before that opportunity was taken. However, that opportunity was presented, and the next 4 pages of transcript are devoted to appellant explaining why the strikes were pretextual and the prosecutor explaining why they're not. If the court really wasn't interested in counsel's arguments, the court probably would have cut that off at some point. Obviously, the court was still paying attention, and obviously the court would have still considered at some point if the prosecutor said, oh, yeah, I guess he is similarly situated, and I got nothing to say to that. To suggest that just because the trial court said, I find that explanation race neutral, which they truly were, even after going through these extra steps, to suggest the trial court wouldn't have considered that is somewhat meritless. In addition, again, there's talk of what is structural error, Batson error, structural error. Well, there's a difference between true Batson error, allowing racial discrimination in the jury selection, and a procedural error committed while going through the Batson procedure, which we think would have to show some kind of prejudice. Here, appellant was able to make all of his pretext arguments. The state was forced to respond to him, and what the record shows, there was not racial discrimination in the jury selection. Therefore, there was absolutely zero prejudice. Structural error analysis is simply not suitable for this, and we would ask that this court find that the Batson challenge was were properly overruled by the court. With that said, if there are any other questions?
The confession was an audio tape rather than video.
Yes, the confession was audio taped, and with both confessions that were audio taped, there was interviews prior to the taped version being made. And so what you hear in the audio tapes were the officers going back over what appellant had already told them in a more narrative form, according to the officers' testimonies. And as for appellant's argument that, well, it doesn't match up with the jail records, it's something she calls reliability, that's really an issue of credibility. It was before the motion court. Motion court found the officer credible, and this court will defer to that determination. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to make sure the court realizes that what we are talking about, what we're challenging, is step three, not step two. We've never disputed that the reasons proffered, that the prosecutor was looking for minor children, that that's a race-neutral reason. What we're saying is when you look at the prosecutor's pattern of conduct at the trial, you know, somebody could have a child who was a day shy of being an adult or a day over being an adult. One would have a minor child, one wouldn't. Wouldn't you ask about that? If this was really important, that's what courts have always said, but there was no question about that. One of the other things I wanted to talk about is, again, and Mr. Starnes talked about it, what's really motivating the strikes here? What's really going on? Well, you know, Johnny's defense was based on his mental health problems. And if you look at that chart again, the prosecutor was pretty consistent in striking jurors who had mental health experience through relatives, close friends, except that when he got to the end, when he was getting down to the end, he struck Miss Gilbert, even though there was another juror who had a cousin, maybe two cousins with mental health problems, and that juror said absolutely they were real problems. You have to say why. This is step three, and this is what the court has to do.
Well, maybe it's possible that the prosecutor was running out of peremptory challenges and had to deal with what was left in the pool.
Well, at that point, the question is, why does he select? You know, they don't have to go when within the pool, they've got something like up to, I don't know, I don't remember what the number is, but they can strike anybody in the pool. So why does he strike this one instead of that one? That's the question. Why does he strike Miss Gilbert, who doesn't have any relatives who have had mental illness, but he strikes and he keeps another juror whose relatives have mental health issues?
That's where really Batson is, as the Attorney General pointed out, Batson's based on race. Other issues are other issues.
But if you look
at not race based, and there could be other issues, for example, employment or lack of employment, which might indicate the different other bias. But Batson's just based on race.
It's up
if
to
it's
the
mental illness issues. That's not the same thing as race.
Well, we're not complaining because he struck people with mental health experience. That's not the point. What I'm saying is, in terms of whether his real reason for striking Miss Gilbert was that she was a student, there's nothing in being a student except his speculative reason that she doesn't have the right life experiences that would make that a good strike for him, except that she's an Asian woman. And this is what Miller L. says. This is what the court said in McFadden. You look side by side at the strikes to see if they make sense in terms of what is a good juror for the prosecutor. And jurors who have relatives or close friends who've had mental health problems are not going to be good jurors for the prosecutor. In fact, he strikes a lot of them. That's why that's an issue, because you look at his pattern of strikes. I do want to talk a little bit about going back to, well, first let me talk a little bit about McFadden, because this came up too. You know, this case is very different from McFadden. This court has just reversed, except that they both come out of St. Louis County. But if McFadden we can think of as being at one end of the spectrum with lots of strikes, racially discriminatory strikes, or gender-related strikes. This question is kind of the other end of the spectrum. It's a little Batson case. It doesn't mean that the discrimination is any less real. This case really tests whether this court will allow a little discrimination because there's only one or two strikes that are bad. And I think that's a fair question. I think you have to really look at things. Judge, I do want to clear up, if I may, there was some question about what the defense was allowed to ask to which panel, and I hope I haven't misled you. They were allowed to ask everybody, could you consider a sentence of life or death? That's not what we're challenging. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I would ask you to give Johnny a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. The court is adjourned.